Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Welcome to this evening's event. My name is Gangar Sridhar, and I'm assistant professor at the Department of Psychological and Behavioral Sciences. It's my great pleasure to chair this evening today, organized by GSOS for the LSE Research Festival. I would like to welcome Adam Met. He's worked with Congress and the White House on energy policy, been named changemaker by the New York Times, and has received Time Magazine's Earth Award. And his debut book, Amplify, which I've been reading and really enjoying, is a bestseller. And it asks a question very close to my own work, which is, how do we get people to care and act around climate change, but importantly, using unconventional creative methods from art and music to collective action? Why do facts so rarely move people? Or do they? And hopefully Adam's going to talk about this and a lot more today, this evening. So please welcome me in. Please join me in welcoming Adam Met. Just a few housekeeping rules. There's no planned fire and alarm, and the event will be recorded and live streamed and made available later as a video and podcast. So Adam will talk for around 20 minutes, and then we'll have a quick discussion, and I'll leave the floor open to questions after that. So thanks again for being here, and welcome everyone. Welcome Adam.
Thank you so much. If I'm back here, can you all hear me on the mic? Okay, great. Excellent. So, my name is Adam, and I wear so many different hats that it might seem a little bit strange. So, yes, by night I am a musician. I tour all over the world playing music. And over the last 15 years or so of doing that, I started to think about the movement that we had effectively built as artists. So when we started out, we were playing for two or three people in a venue, and we never signed a traditional record label deal. We never did a traditional kind of distribution deal. All of our music was shared by word of mouth. And so when we started playing, it was for two or three people, and then we would do another tour, and then 50 people would show up, and then we would do another show, another tour, and a few hundred people would show up. Until around 2024, we started to sell out arenas. And so we did a 50-city arena tour across the United States, and then came here and played a lot of different shows. We did 13 cities in the UK, we did across Europe, we did Asia, we did Australia and New Zealand. And over those 15 years, I really started to think about, what would it take to build an effective movement, build an effective fan base, the way we did with music, but for a variety of social issues? And when I was in high school, so in the US I was about 16 years old, I went on a field trip to see someone speak, and that person was Mary Robinson. And if you're not familiar with Mary Robinson, she was the former president of Ireland, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. She's incredible. And as a 16-year-old, seeing her speak and make the connection between sustainable development and human rights, that set me on my path to continue my academic journey studying all of these things. So while we've been on the road growing this fan base, I stayed in school. So I did my undergrad and then my master's, and then I came to the UK, to the University of Birmingham, to do my PhD, and I studied human rights law and sustainable development, and I cited Mary Robinson more than any other person when I was doing my PhD. And last year at Climate Week, we actually did a panel together on stage, and we ended up dancing on stage together. So she has become a friend. But it really just took that one person when I was a kid to set me on this path. Now, the variety of other things that I do all come back to this central idea around research and turning it into action. So yes, I stayed in school. Yes, we built this band. But this idea of what we call action research at my organization called Planet Reimagined is, as you are doing research in order to solve big problems in the world, you need to be thinking about the implementation. Of course, in many spaces, doing research for the sake of research is incredibly important because you don't know where the solutions are going to end up coming from. However, in a lot of climate change work, because it's so timely in order to move the ball down the field as quickly as possible, we think about research with an eye towards implementation. And I'll give you some examples. As we're doing this research, we will think about, okay, what does it need to make it real in the world? But as we're making it real in the world, we also do more research and create this kind of feedback loop. So it's not just research living in a place like an academic institution or a think tank, and it's not just implementation living at an advocacy organization or a tech company, right? It's more about an integrated approach. And so this is what Planet Reimagined does. It creates a bridge between how research is done and how work is implemented. And I'll give you a couple of examples. So when the Inflation Reduction Act was being negotiated in Congress, are we familiar with the Inflation Reduction Act? Okay. For those of you who aren't, it was pretty much the largest climate policy that came out of the United States and one of the largest around the world. And it was really significant for a bunch of reasons, but I spent a lot of time in Congress working on the Inflation Reduction Act, especially around the indigenous-owned energy provisions, because that's what my PhD was in. And when I would run around Congress, I would speak to Republicans and I would speak to Democrats. I would speak both on both sides of the aisle. And even though no Republicans ended up voting for the final bill, I found a lot of overlap between how Republicans thought about energy issues and how Democrats thought about energy issues. And the main thing that overlapped between them was effective land use. And so I brought that back to the team at Planet Reimagined, and we developed a model to put renewable energy, namely solar and wind, on top of current oil and gas leases in the United States. Now, if you think about that, it's a no-brainer, right? There's huge amounts of land. There's actually about 18 million acres of land of oil and gas leases in the western part of the United States. We did an analysis to figure out where we should be putting solar, where we should be putting wind. And with these 18 million acres, we figured out that we can generate about over 400 gigawatts of new renewable energy just on this land that's already been disturbed. And because you are in this room, I assume you know that that means it's a lot of energy that's not being considered in any equation yet. This isn't really being done anywhere in the world, but one of the things that we did in our research was figure out how to build this in a way that it was enticing to Republicans and was enticing to Democrats. We don't want to do things that are going to change based on what administration is in power. So we built this model. We built a whole mapping tool. We worked on this policy. It's been introduced in both the House and the Senate in the U.S. We have Republican and Democrat support. I testified in front of Congress. And that, over 400 gigawatts, is enough to power about 101 million homes in the United States per year. It's a ridiculously large amount of power. And so now we're working with oil and gas companies and working with renewable developers to start building these kinds of projects. That took research, thinking about the policy side, thinking about the engineering side, thinking about the community side, because a lot of what we have done already is working with these communities to understand how they benefit from the oil and gas leases, how we can ensure that they're continuing to get those kinds of benefits, and what they would need in order to build renewables in their communities. It really is a multi-stakeholder analysis. And even though we are already starting to work with these various companies, we are continuing the research process. So this is what I mean, that research does not sit in a separate bucket from implementation. It requires this kind of constant process. I'll give you another example. We built an AI platform called Grapevine. And you might be thinking, oh, no, shouldn't be using AI for climate. And I'm going to give you an example of an AI tool that can actually be really, really useful for climate. So when Donald Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement for the second time about a year and a half ago, I said, okay, we are gathering all of this data at the city level and the state level, right? We have all of this data, what's happening at the city and the state level, and we're passing it on to the UN to kind of replicate an NDC, even though we are not reporting to the UN anymore. What if we took that data and spread it horizontally between cities and between states? How can we use things that work in one place and replicate them in others? So we've built this platform now that can suck in from any city the regulatory environment of that city, the political environment of that city, and community sentiment. And it can understand how a policy came to be. So over time, it looks at community board meetings. We've sucked in thousands of hours of video of community board meetings, town council meetings, to understand everybody that participated in making that policy came to be. And then we can take another city that has not implemented that policy and rewrite that policy so it can work in that environment, or that environment, or that environment, or that environment. So think of the implications of this. We can use AI effectively to take something that works and spread it everywhere. And we've done this with a policy around neighborhood decarbonization. For if you don't know what that is, when a gas company is replacing a pipeline underneath the street, instead of replacing it with another gas pipeline, there's an opportunity to replace it with hot water powered by geothermal. And that way, you get to decarbonize by neighborhood instead of incentivizing people to put solar on their individual homes. So you get to go neighborhood by neighborhood, block by block, as opposed to individual house by individual house. And there are a bunch of cities that are doing this really well, and there are a bunch of cities, because of the regulatory environment and political environments, that could be doing this well, but have no idea that this is something that's open to them. So this platform, we're working with a variety of mayors and governors and policymakers and communities across the US now in order to implement this. So again, this takes the same kind of research in order to build this platform to figure out the policies. And by the way, it's what we call a human in the loop platform. So for those of you who are not familiar with AI terminology, we are not replacing anybody's jobs. We are always maintaining humans in the loop for this. It is going to require humans to engage with this directly. It's just helping to speed up. And for any of you who know the process of local policymaking, it takes a really, really long time. From all of the policymakers that we've been working with, it helps them speed up the process by a few years by taking in all of this data. So those are two examples. We'll talk about one of the ones we've done around music and around sports. We did a really big study with Ticketmaster, the music promoter, to figure out how to do better advocacy around sports and music. And instead of asking people at concerts to pledge to change the kind of straw that they're using, we've built this strategy to allow people to take direct civic and political action on site at concerts. We did this on my tour. We did this in the UK on 13 of Billie Eilish's shows, including the one at the O2 here, actually a couple at the O2, and in Manchester and a variety of other places. And when I say direct action, it was actually direct action. So we've had people pick up the phone to call their representatives on site at concerts while they're sitting waiting for the main act to go on. I'll give you an example. In the US, in Phoenix, Arizona, we pulled into Phoenix, Arizona, and I don't know what the centigrade conversion is, but in Fahrenheit, it was 109 degrees out. Can anyone do that in their head, what the centigrade conversion is? Thank you.
Excellent.
Thank you. 38. 38 degrees. So that's pretty hot. We pulled in, it was 38 degrees, and the action we had on site was fans signing petitions to get their local town council to unlock more dollars to combat extreme heat. Additional tree cover, cooling zones, things like that. We got over 1,000 signatures in that one night on the petition. The petition ended up moving to the city council, and it ended up moving the process forward to unlock dollars to combat extreme heat. This kind of direct action is the kind of thing we need to be doing more of. And so we just came off of the Tame Impala tour in Europe. We did Tyler Childers and Renee Rapp in the United States. We're doing a bunch more festivals and a bunch more artists this year. But one of my favorite stories is we did this in Manchester, like I said, with Billie Eilish. And there was a young woman who came and participated in this action. She had never participated in climate action before. She participated on site. It was an action around the climate and nature bill that was being negotiated. And she took this action, and then she asked how she could continue to participate. She ended up going back to her own town, and now she has about 150 volunteers that she organized around climate action. Now, she had never participated in anything before. This was in partnership with Green New Deal Rising. You might be familiar with this organization. So now she has about 150 people that volunteer with her that she organized. That is how you build an effective movement. One of the things that we like to talk about a lot is this term that I love that the sociologist Durkheim coined called collective effervescence. Collective effervescence. Are we familiar with Emile Durkheim? He was a sociologist. He wrote a book called Elementary Forms of Religious Life, in addition to a lot of other writing. He took this idea of collective effervescence, which essentially means when you're in the same room, when you're in the same space with other people, when you have the same aim and the same goal, and there's energy around it, your brain waves start to meld, and you start to have this kind of larger-than-life experience. And I'll explain it. He wrote about it in terms of religion. But imagine you're at a concert, right? You're listening to music. You know pretty much no one else there. But over time, you're singing with these other people. You're dancing with these other people. There's this collective effervescence. And I love the term. It just sounds so good. There's this collective effervescence. And we said, what if we could take that thing, that kind of sparkle that was happening at concerts or at sports events, and move people to action using that? And so that's what we did with this program. Now, the work at Planet Reimagined, we are an incubator. So as you can see, we do a lot of different things. There are different teams working on different projects. They're happening at different speeds. Some are in tech, some are in policy, some are in movement building. But we all use this same strategy of action research. We start with the research, we start to implement, and then we do more research. And then we implement, and then we do more research. Even on the Tame Impala tour that we just did in Europe, for those of you not familiar, Tame Impala is a band. They just finished a quite sizable European tour, and they came here as well. We were doing research on the ground of fans' participation. We were asking them about the kinds of actions they're willing to take, how they enjoyed or didn't enjoy their participation in taking these actions, and what they were willing to do as follow-ups after the concert to stay involved. So that gives you the kind of idea of what Planet Reimagined is. And all of that came out of myself and my co-founder. She, her name is Myla Rosenthal. She was the head of advocacy and comms at UNDP. Before that, she was a deputy director at Amnesty International. She came from these big organizations. And I came from a scrappy band that built this thing that I had no idea what I was doing. So the two of us together kind of built this organization. And everything I do in my life now, I sit on the board of the Environmental Defense Fund. I work with politicians and mayors and governors around the world on their climate strategy and climate communications. But it's all based on this action research. But none of this would be impactful at all unless we figured out the right way to speak to our audiences. So one of the things we think about from zero is the kind of language that we use in order to affect behavioral change. I'm not saying changing the kind of straw you use. I'm talking about the kind of behavioral change in order to get policies passed, in order to build movements, in order to move people to vote on certain issues. Sometimes it might be using the framing of climate change and sustainability, and sometimes it might not be using that language at all. We did a tour in the US with an artist named Tyler Childers, country artist, really incredible artist. But a lot of his audience is not really focused on climate as their issue. The shows we did were in Virginia and West Virginia. Something that impacts everybody, and there's 1 or 2 degrees of separation, is this thing called black lung disease, which you get from working in coal mines. There's still a huge amount of coal mines and coal mine workers in these places. So we went into climate action via black lung disease, via making sure people had access to health and understanding the relationship between coal and how it impacts their families. We didn't once mention climate change. We didn't once mention sustainability or the environment. This is happening a lot, and for me, I completely understand that there are companies and governments around the world that are scrubbing climate language from their websites. But if that means that we can be even more effective and move faster if we use other paths to get things done, I am a get things done kind of person. And therefore, I am willing to change the language I'm using in order to work with different audiences. When I was working on the strategy to put renewable energy on top of oil and gas land with Republicans, I would talk about job creation, I would talk about economics, and I would talk about clean energy. And when I was working with Democrats, I would talk about net zero, 1.5 degrees, carbon reduction, and renewable energy. The difference between clean energy and renewable energy a few years ago in the US Congress made the difference between getting Republicans and Democrats on board. So the language, while we are, of course, doing this research and implementation, the language is really a key part of it in order to be able to move things forward. So all the while, I've maintained my music career underneath all of this stuff that I'm doing in climate. And a lot of people ask me the question about how am I doing two things at once, right? How am I continuing to be on tour and do this work in music and do this climate work? I don't see them as two separate things. I see both of the things and the variety of other things that I'm doing really as one approach. In music, because we never signed a traditional label deal, it was from the beginning, how do we build an effective movement? How do we get one person to tell five other people to get 100 other people in this room? And that's how we ended up selling out arenas. It's the same thing in climate. It's what are the tools you're using in order to attract one person to get it to 10 people, to 100 people, to thousands of people participating in whatever area of the climate movement you're talking about. So whether you're working in music or any other form of art, or you're working in science, or you're working in policy or movement building, for me, it really ultimately comes down to the same thing, which is how to effectively engage your audiences in order to move them forward. And again, it's a language thing, it's a research thing, it's an implementation thing, and that's kind of how I ended up here doing all of these variety of things, which in my mind is just one thing. But I will pause there. I don't have a clock, so I don't know if we hit our goal time of 20 minutes or so of me talking. Perfect. Excellent. And now I think I hit the kind of things that you were looking for, yeah? That we can open
perfect.
Up for discussion.
That was fascinating. And thank you so much for those examples of the work you did as well, because it really sparked a lot of ideas for me. I'll ask two questions and then I'll open it up to the floor for audience questions. So I guess the first thing, as someone who sort of straddles both an artistic practice as well as law, regulation, lobbying, policy, a question I had was actually, what is the difference between art and fact in facilitating behavior change? Is there a difference? Because if you think about framing, which is something you've referred to in terms of how you pitch a particular idea to someone or what frame you use, there's a bit of art in that, isn't there?
Yeah.
So a few thoughts there.
Yeah. It's funny, when I was thinking about the subtitle for my book, the book is called Amplify, and my publisher didn't like this, so it didn't end up being the subtitle, but I'll share it with you all. I really wanted to use the terms, you know, the art and science of building a movement. And then I kept going back and forth. Should it be the science and art, or should it be the art and science? And really, for me, those are two sides of the same coin. To be able to effectively express fact, and I'm using science as kind of a stand-in for it, but to use art to effectively express science, and to use science as a way to drive communication, art as a way of evoking emotion, of driving communication, I think they are two sides of the same thing, much like how I think about the research and action piece of it. Now, art obviously can manifest in so many different ways. We've found that music, not the music itself, not the music that you're listening to, but the platform that artists have, is really a different kind of art than a lot of others in conveying information about climate action and conveying the kinds of actions that people can take. We found that with actors, it's a lot harder because actors spend a lot of their life not being themselves, right? They're reading somebody else's words, they're performing what somebody else wants them to perform. So as you think about, I don't know, some famous actor, as you think about them, that's not who they are as people. More often than not, musicians, when they're sharing stuff online or if they write their own music, that's more likely to be who they are as a person. And if you can directly connect with those kinds of people, and the age of social media has made that so much easier, then asking people to take action works so much better. Now, there are, of course, many different kinds of art. One of my favorite examples was there was an opera that was at Lincoln Center in New York. And there was a climate protest that happened in the middle of the opera, and it was timed so perfectly because of what the theme of the opera was. And so I really love when climate action is thought through in the context of art, because having art that actually has themes around climate without shoving it down people's throats is great. The number of people who have come to me and said, okay, we're going to COP this year, will you write a theme song for COP? That is never going to work. That is absolutely never going to be something. But if you listen closely, there are a lot of artists on the charts now that incorporate themes of social action into their lyrics, not as a protest song like it was in the 1970s, but because it's part of their day-to-day experience. So I'll give you an example. One of our songs, it's called Inertia, and it's not a song about climate change, but there's a line in the pre-chorus that goes, I was gonna save the planet, but today I've got plans. It's real, it's something we were experiencing, but to use art in order to communicate that effectively is great, but only if you have an on-ramp for people to actually participate. And that's what we do at our shows, and a lot of the other artists are as well now.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because that's a question I had, because often people move away because I guess art engages emotions in a way, which I guess it depends on the type of art, but selecting into that as a hedonistic experience, and then having it spoiled by someone preaching at you is no fun.
Yeah.
So that's a question I had. So in a way, the idea would be to pitch to be a genuine, authentic person who the audience relates to, you have following with, and then sort of slip it in there. So it's more about the context rather than the actual piece of art itself.
It absolutely is. And when I think about the artists that have done it well, it's never, oh, this thing is happening in the news, so I should post about it on my social media and get my fans to activate. The best example is when Taylor Swift endorsed Kamala Harris for president of the US. That went really well, right? There was no engagement previously leading up to that moment around the issues. And you have artists like Billie Eilish and like Shawn Mendes. And for example, when I started my PhD, I was sharing all of that information with fans. I talked to them about applying for the process and what my topic was going to be and brought them along on the journey. When people have ownership over the process, it's much more likely that they're going to stay involved long term than if it becomes preachy in any way.
Yeah, super interesting. In terms of the mechanism as well, I guess we in behavioral science, we use the word emotional contagion, which sort of, but effervescence is much more bubbly and emotional. So I sort of prefer that to contagion, which has pandemic vibes. So another question actually on the method of action research.
Yeah.
Could you talk to me a bit more about that and how that actually changes the sort of, I guess, intervention that you do on the ground? Because often that's part of the issue. So I sort of like the image of everyone having fun at a concert and then, you know, people being asked to do the petition. I think that's a brilliant idea, actually, harnessing that entire sort of mass of people to take an action right then and there. But how do you actually change that if you get feedback that I don't like this or this is not something I want to do now? How does that actually change the way you work? Maybe both in like a concert sort of public venue, but also maybe something from the policy work.
Sure.
That would be interesting, yeah.
So we will always start with the research side. So we hope to be at least 80% of the way there because we've started with the research. And so I'll give you an example. Like I said, we did this big study with Ticketmaster before we started on any of these tours. This poll went out to about 350,000 people that had recently attended a concert in the previous 6 months. We asked them everything from the kinds of issues they cared about to the actions that they were willing to take to where they were going to take these actions. Was it going to be in the car on the way to the concert? Was it going to be on the concourse while they were in their seat in the middle of the show? Was it going to be before the artist started to perform? Was it going to be while you were sitting on the toilet with a QR code on the back of the door? We literally asked that question. Would people want to take action from their phone doing that?
I imagine and so, that was popular.
That one was popular, yeah. So we got all of this data and built our program around this research. So therefore, we were 80% of the way there. The other thing we polled is about artists participating in this kind of climate action and if they were going to get negative feedback from fans, because that is a big concern for artists. It turns out there was an era that I like to call the shut up and sing era, which is when everyone wanted the artists to just be quiet and focus on their art and not engage in any social issues. It turns out from all of our polling, and a bunch of other people have replicated this, that that era is over. People want their artists and their idols, for lack of a better word, to be well-rounded, to be real people. And because you have so much access to them now, like I was saying on social media, they expect a lot more of these artists. They expect to understand more about their day-to-day lives, why they make decisions, why they speak publicly about issues, or why they don't speak publicly about issues. So the fact that an artist would ask people to act around climate change, there's one really clear distinction. We've found that if artists say to fans, we want you to do this, take this action, fans are not very likely to participate. Mm. But if the artists say, I'm doing this, come join me in taking this action, it goes up tenfold, the participation rates, because people want to do something with the artist. And it's such a simple language change. It's like what we were talking about before. But when you do the research and that kind of thing comes to light, then you can implement it. But yes, we get people at every show as we're doing research saying, I want artists to shut up and sing. But that number is dwindling. That is smaller than 20% now of people. And so it gives artists cover. The other thing I'll mention on the data side is that because fans expect artists to participate in this kind of thing, they actually have a more positive view of the artist when they see this kind of work being embedded in social media, on tours, things like that. So it gives artists this other layer of cover that the fans expect it. It's not just that the fans will be okay with it, it's that that's an expectation of fans that the artists actually participate in things that they care about.
Yeah.
Oh, and I didn't give a policy side example, but on the, for example, on our Common Grounds project, which is the renewable energy sitting on top of oil and gas land, when we first started with this, we took a completely academic approach to the research, right? Where is there additional grid capacity? Where is transmission hookup? What does the North Slope analysis look like? Where can we be putting solar? Where would be the most effective, right? That didn't really engage directly with the oil and gas companies and their concerns about perception in these communities, right, or the renewable energy developers who want to increase their perception in the communities. In the West, in the US, oil and gas, the royalties from oil and gas, funds hospitals, funds schools, funds social services, funds baseball teams. It really is deeply embedded in the community. And so as we did the initial research part of it, we needed to go back to understand what the kind of interaction and relation between these stakeholders was that you couldn't get from that initial level of research. And so that's why we needed to do that embedded community work.
Okay. Super. I'm going to open this up. Otherwise, I could keep talking. So, got one question there. We'll take it in threes. Got one more question there. I would like someone who is female. Sorry, I'll come back to you, I promise.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
That way? Perfect. I'm going to go for you because I saw her first and then I'll come to you. So I've got two more on tap. Yeah.
Thank you so much. A very interesting talk. I was interested more in, I guess, like a less climate action-y question and more pedagogical question of having complex identities in humans is very good. We know that it creates more perspective-taking ideas and we're more empathetic towards others when we have more complex identities. But I think we live in a meritocratical way that it's like, if you're an artist, only do it if you're really good, at least in the States. But stay in school as a fallback. There's only if you're really good at one thing, but always stay in school if you have a fallback.
Yeah.
But you decided, you said, you keep them as one. How do we create people to see two topics that, in maybe society, that are considered very distant into one that creates a more complex identities within education or taking that route?
Yeah, I love this question.
Okay, but
oh, sorry, we're going to take all three.
We had one more here, yeah. Just request to also keep it pithy, so we have time for more.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, because I really loved your action research kind of point. I also wanted to kind of ask, as an independent researcher, I've always wondered how to kind of do action research, but I never really had the funding. So what would you suggest to an independent researcher in like the kind of, how would they do action research?
Great.
Fantastic, thank you. And one question there.
Hello, thank you for coming with us today.
I think you need to go a bit closer to the, yeah.
You spoke a little bit about using language as a method to motivate disengaged factions to participate in environmental change. How does this overuse and greenwashing of certain environmental terms impact public trust? And do you think that this linguistic dilution will cause people to reject environmental messaging altogether or deflect attention away from the root cause of climate issues?
Thank you.
Ah, three fantastic questions. Okay, I'm very excited. The first question, I think that the university space is primed for change around this exact topic. When I was an undergrad, I did my my first degree at Columbia, and we were really pushed to choose one thing to focus on. And whether you're studying economics or political science or international relations or climate science or English or history, all of these things are so inextricably linked that I think it is the responsibility of the university system to require more interdisciplinarity in academia. And I think we are moving towards that, and we see more universities allowing for cross-registering of students across departments, and I think that's fantastic. And one of the things that I would encourage, and I'm not sure if LSE permits this, so feel free to just, you know, push back against this or delete this from the live stream if you don't want people seeing this.
Too late.
is if you're going to do a senior project or a thesis project, to have it be cross-disciplinary. And so when you're studying something around climate, and because I'm guessing that most of you are somehow adjacent to climate, inevitably, you're going to have to do something that crosses between policy and between science and between psychology and between all of these different areas. So pick something that requires you to go deep in all of these different areas. My master's degree was at a school at New York University. It's a school there called Gallatin. And it's a school of individualized study where you can take classes in pretty much any department. So I took some of my classes in the law school and some of my classes in at the public policy school and some in a variety of different departments. As much as you can, suck in information from a variety of spaces. I think about it the way I think about our AI tool that we're building. We would never make a policy recommendation to a city if we were just looking at the political environment of that city. That makes absolutely no sense. So why would we silo out the way we're studying things? So completely agree with the premise of your question. Action research as an independent, just to review, as an independent researcher, somebody who doesn't have a lot of funding to do the independent research, it's not an altogether very different answer to that question. In thinking about the kind of people that would use the research that you are producing, those are the kinds of partnerships that I would start to develop. Now, that might be that you don't have funding to finish the research, but to go to organizations that are taking the kind of thing that you're doing and implementing them, I would say start in civil society and start in universities. And going to places that have the ability to either partner with you to get funding for them, or they can bring you on as, you know, a researcher or even like a part-time scholar, something like that, to help develop it. But I think that these kinds of partnerships we're going to see more and more of. Because I'm on the board of the Environmental Defense Fund, which is a really big organization, I also work with a bunch of smaller organizations across the US and around the world, and they are looking for these kinds of projects that they can take on. I would say that think of the university as a great place to do this, but also how can you foster partnerships outside of universities in other areas of civil society? And that's a great question. Another great question, the language piece of it and the greenwashing and if it's going to decrease people's interest in participating and it's gonna lower the level of interaction. I have a take on this that is probably not very popular. And it's that I don't think the climate movement should exist. I know that sounds very strange. I think that we would be so much more effective as movements if they were broken up into a movement around transportation, if it was a movement around energy, a movement around water, around agriculture, around waste, around production, around construction. If I say climate change to the average person, they would not know how to get involved in something related to climate change. Most people in the world don't know what net zero is or 1.5 degrees, or honestly, even the word sustainability. It's so existential and far away, but if you talk about how your kids are getting to and from school, the mode of transportation, if you talk about how food is ending up on your plate, I understand that, you know, there are a variety of administrations, including the one in the US, that are erasing this kind of climate language. Even before Trump was elected the second time, I started to see a move away from this kind of big picture language of climate. And I think that's a good thing because it allows us to drill down and be more specific about the kinds of things that we want to achieve. When you have people protesting on the street asking for more climate action, that's great. But I'll give you an example. I was in Omaha, Nebraska. And if you don't know where that is, it's directly in the middle of the United States. And there was a protest going on, and they asked me to come speak at the protest. And I arrive at the protest, and they are talking about rising sea levels at this protest. Literally in the middle of the United States, nowhere near the ocean, they're talking about rising sea levels. And so I immediately change what I'm talking about in my speech, and I say, look, the way to address the thing that you want, and they were protesting in front of the State House where there were policymakers. There are policymakers right there. What's the thing you want from Nebraska policymakers? It was the thing that they should have been asking for was around specific agricultural policies. Agriculture is a really big thing in the middle of the country. They produce a lot of wheat and corn, soy, things like that. So when you drill down to exactly what you want the outcome to be, that's what we should be focusing on in terms of the language. Sure, if we want to create convenings like this or other kind of things like London Climate Week, which is happening next week, within the movement itself, sure, we can continue to use the terms of climate change and net zero and 1.5, as long as we're sure that everyone understands what those mean. But if you're trying to build a bigger movement and attract people where they are in their lives, it's much more about how are you going to get to and from places? How is the food going to end up on your plate? How are you going to decrease costs of electricity? Things like that.
Amazing. Thank you. One question here, and I had a hand here as well. That hand has disappeared, but I will take your hand instead. So one there, and one at the back. That was you. I found you. Okay. Could we have a mic for...
Thank you so much. Hello, Adam. I have a question in terms of your role as an artist, because just now you bring up about using different languages for different groups. How do you see yourself as a center of this movement in order to unify the people when you have previously catered to their languages, and how do you bring them together into one space that can potentially make a bigger impact? And then, another one, if you may, how do you find the balance between talking to a group, small group that can make the biggest change, and also catering to the mass audience in order to create an impact and reach an impression?
Yeah. Amazing, thank you. And then?
Thank you so much for the talk. So my research is actually on corporate and brand activism, and similar to artists, there's growing pressure on brands to take part in societal action. So my question is, because recent evidence from the branding literature keeps showing that activism works in changing attitudes, but for consumers who are already aligned and their values are congruent, while for those consumers who are on the opposite side, it actually causes a backlash, yeah, and consumers react negatively toward the brand. So given that you already had examples from the concert, I'm curious, is everyone in these concerts already aligned, their values are aligned with these causes, or is there a major role of the artists that they can actually change attitudes, especially with increasing polarization?
Hi, thank you for the talk. I was curious about your work with Indigenous-owned energy solutions. There are often fundamental conflicts between Indigenous groups and North American governments,
yes,
because of different cultural relationships with land and resources. I was wondering what bridges or ways of connecting these groups you might have noticed during your own research.
Great. Was there one more?
No.
Okay.
Right, and then we'll go again.
Great. I'm going to start with your second point. Actually, can I go backwards through these questions? The last question. So one of my favorite examples of this was actually about 50 pages in the middle of my PhD. There's a First Nation in Canada called the Okikendawat First Nation in Ontario, and they did something pretty extraordinary. So they had a significant amount of their members, their band, that's called band members, ending up leaving their community because there was no real way to fund schools, hospitals, things like that. People would leave to go to school, people would leave for jobs, and yet they had a river running through their community. And so one of the things that they did was they brought in a company to build a hydropower plant, which ended up generating a huge amount of income for their community. But because of the way that the land rights work in Canada, specifically in Ontario, they had the opportunity to interview a variety of different companies who would allow them to continue to uphold their own cultural rights, which is something that not every company was willing to do because of kind of profits that they needed to hit. So they interviewed about, I don't know, 10 or so different companies, and they finally found one that allowed the local community, the First Nation, to maintain 40% ownership stake, but built into the contract their cultural rights. And so when you have this kind of shared incentive, and one of their cultural rights, for example, turtles are an incredibly important part of their culture. So built into the contract itself was, if there is any turtle on site, all construction must pause, they must remove the turtle, and then they can keep going. They also built in a bunch of other economic and social rights into the project itself. So when you have the opportunity for these communities to be educated on what they can do first, then they can move towards the profit-sharing ownership stage, and then that model can end up being replicated. So now it's being replicated across Canada. There are some examples in Australia where it's being replicated, but it requires that first step. It's almost like the action research thing again. It's giving them the power to say, okay, these are all the things that you can do. It's not just a black and white option. It's not just, do you want to exist the way you exist, or do you want a company to come in and take over everything? There's so many resources on these indigenous lands that companies want that their negotiating power is much stronger than they think it is, and they just need that kind of education process to jumpstart it. So I focused on Bangladesh and Kenya and Canada, indigenous communities in those three places in my PhD, and this was an example that we end up creating a model for of what we call a development-based approach to human rights. Traditionally, you think of it as a human rights-based approach to development, where you know you're doing a development project and you kind of say, okay, let's make sure we're protecting human rights. We did the opposite. We said, human rights are the bedrock of this. We want to make sure we're protecting human rights. That's kind of step zero. How do we make sure these communities are able to develop in order to keep members home and close to home and build those kinds of resources while human rights are primacy? So that's probably the best example that I can think of. I think like 3 people in total have ever read my PhD dissertation, but it is available online. Okay. Activism. traditionally only in the for the people who are already values aligned, right? So one of the things that I think about a lot is that there was a study that came out, I think it was in February or March, that north of 70% of people in the world believe climate change is real and that governments need to be doing more about it. One of the biggest inhibitors is that people don't believe that their friends, family, and neighbors agree with them. That's one of the biggest problems. So the overwhelming loud voice of the minority, they are very good at making their opinions known on social media and in person. And so one of the most important things that I think about a lot in places of where activism is happening is bringing people out of the woodwork who already agree, and more people agree than we think agree. However, it goes back to my point before of language, that in order to get people to admit that they agree, it's not necessarily going to use the same language for everybody. When you think about activism, and especially in the climate space, like I was saying before, they'll use the framing of climate change, of sustainability, of environmental justice, obviously all incredibly important things. However, you're much more likely to get that overwhelming majority out of the woodwork if it's really specific and focused on their individual lives. And I think the role of the artist in those kinds of spaces is to make it accessible to people. When an artist tours in different communities, we change the action that the artist is asking for the people to participate in depending on what's relevant to that community. So I gave Phoenix as the example. We chose that because it was really hot in Phoenix, and so extreme heat was the action. In every single city, it's something different depending on what matters to that city. Some cities, there are things around water. Some cities, there are things around data centers. Some things there are, it's really just different depending on the city. That, you have much less of that kind of big vocal pushback if you can get more of those people out of the woodwork, because then the data ends up flipping, right? You have the people who are in the actually in the minority afraid to actually come out and say that they're in the minority because they're afraid that their friends and family aren't going to agree with them. Does that make sense? Okay. The first question, the second piece of it was the small groups versus the mass impact. I think that from all of the research that we've done, it is so much more impactful for artists to do things when people are in person in these smaller groups. I mean, even an arena is a small group of, 10,000 people compared to when sharing something online. It is so much more impactful for people to take action in person than it is to do something digitally in order to, have some sort of mass awareness. In the climate space, we are way past the need for a lot more awareness. We are much more in the space where we need people to take action. If that action happens in person, that's where we need to be focusing. I spend a lot of time in conversations in New York and here in London, talking about the role of media, the role that media plays in preserving democracy around the world. And people who are talking about, okay, there are a lot of people on the right who are buying up these big media companies in order to move their views to the right. And one of the things that they keep forgetting about is the role of in-person. In-person is a category of media that needs to be addressed just as much as these large-scale media companies. And so I think that we undervalue the potential that people meeting in person has. One of the things that we do at our concerts and a bunch of others is when you have people take an action on site, we make sure that the story doesn't end there. We always follow up with an email or a text message that's coming from the artist. It's actually coming from the local organization that we partner with, but it says it's coming from the artist, and the artist approves, inviting them to something else in person. The second action that we're asking them to take should never be a digital-only action. It should be come to a town council meeting, come to a community board meeting, come to a meetup, because we found that when people meet with each other in person, building that community, they're much more likely to stay engaged longer term. And that gets into the first part of your question. That is what I think the role of the artist is, to act as a way for these organizations who are doing these actions to bring more people to them. I'm not saying that we should be giving artists' social media accounts over to scientists and these other places. While there is a space for that, you run into a language problem, but if you can have the artists build the pathway towards people taking more action and doing more activism, I think that's where the real win is going to be, in person.
Interesting. Just a quick note, that sort of pluralistic ignorance idea, which you mentioned, I think is quite important. There's lots of good evidence for that. The idea that we often underestimate the norm and support for climate policy as well as public action, and often that is the psychological barrier. Question here from online, I think. We've got time for two more questions apart from this one. One here and maybe one at the back.
Yep. There are three questions from online audiences, and I read. First question is from Anna, a marketer from Atlanta, US. The question is, what is your biggest pet peeve when it comes to climate communications, besides the wrong language and examples you gave, and what would you do instead?
Okay.
Second question is from Barney Jordan, a retired teacher from Bolton. The question is, many people want to turn away from difficult climate truths. The National Emergency Briefing aims to clarify the issues. Do you have advice for building a movement based on these briefings? Okay. Third question is from Matthew, a visiting lecturer at LSE. The question is, the book How to Blow Up a Pipeline argues that historically, direct action works when it targets the infrastructure of oppression and deploys a variety of tactics, including property destruction. In contrast, the climate movement has been historically committed to pacifism, an action that is within the boundaries of what is legal. What is your take on direct action and civil disobedience?
Yeah.
Apologies. I think for the sake of time, we'll stick to the three online questions, but hopefully we can have a little time afterwards.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to start with the last one. So this idea of direct action and traditionally the climate movement being more passive, I think there is room and necessity for all of it. I'm going to go back to, so when Joe Biden was president and he signed the Inflation Reduction Act, Kamala Harris gave a speech in the Rose Garden at the signing of the Inflation Reduction Act, shouting out specific groups that it was necessary to have their involvement in order to get the bill passed. And some of those groups that she talked about were ones that did this kind of really disruptive direct action. And it was very clear that the bill wouldn't have gotten through if it didn't have this kind of more passive work around policy all the way through the kind of disruptive action, like from the book, How to Blow Up a Pipeline.
It's a radical flank effect.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, radical flank effect. That's exactly right. So it needs all of these kinds of areas of participation. Me personally, I've been to a number of protests around the world. I participated in direct action, but I feel like my strength lies slightly to the side of that, but I don't disavow that by any stretch of the imagination. It's incredibly important. I'm not sure I understood the second question well, but I'm gonna do the pet peeve one. My biggest pet peeve is when people say net zero and do not describe what they mean by net zero, because it is such like a cheap catch-all. Is it like 98% carbon offsets and 2% changing the kind of systemic action that you're doing? Or is it, you know, 98% changing the kind of work you're doing and 2% carbon offsets? Also, what are the carbon offsets you're using in order to try and get there? Are they just a whole bunch of BS carbon offsets? So my biggest pet peeve is net zero, just using that as a catch-all, as a phrase. And in London Climate Week, if you're going to any of the events, I bet you will hear that phrase thousands of times. And so if you're going to ask a question, ask people to explain what they mean by net zero.
I think we're at time.
Okay.
We've had so many questions. It's been amazing. Apologies to the question about the national emergency briefing. I think it was a really important one, but it is 6:30. I'm very sorry we weren't able to answer that. I thank you all for coming and your amazing participation and the questions. Thank you so much, Adam.
Thank you for having me. This is great.
And thank you to the organizers.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.